This is a special announcement from It's All Politics, the podcast. This week, I, Ron Elving, will allow Ken Rudin to finish his sentences. I will not interrupt him, and I will allow him to complete every thought. Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm
Ken Rudin.
All right, I'm sorry. I apologize. Well, a listener did say that...
The listener?
Yeah, a listener wrote and said that you...
completed your sentences?
Yeah, and a lot of times she was upset.
Because you hesitated and I just leaped into the breach?
And she was upset to the fact that you...
finished your sentences.
Yeah.
Because, well, listen, if we could finally get you sentenced to something, you know, that would really keep you in the
like
pokey
the podcast
for a good long time, then we wouldn't have this problem.
Speaking of the hokey pokey, big news in Congress this week. John Boehner was not overthrown as Speaker. The bad news is that the Republicans made him Speaker again.
Well,
hasn't he suffered enough?
That was said. It was widely said, as a matter of fact, that one of the main reasons that John Boehner was returned as the Speaker was because nobody else really seemed to want the job. Now, that's silly, of course. There are a lot of other members of the House, a lot of other members of the Republican Party who would love to be Speaker. But they didn't want to challenge John right. Boehner and take a chance on failing to unseat him.
Yeah, I mean, nobody challenged him, although the person who got the most votes other than John Boehner was Nancy Pelosi. She would like to be Speaker, too.
Yes. In fact, she has been Speaker.
Yes, she has.
And for two Congresses, 4 years of Congress, between 2007 and 2010. And she was there again, of course, today, gave a very nice speech introducing John Boehner, and which is tradition for the minorities leader to make that kind of speech. And then, of course, he gave a speech. Let's listen to a little bit of what John Boehner had to say.
You come here humbled by the opportunity to serve. If you've come here to be the determined voice of the people, if you've come here to carry the standard of leadership demanded not by our constituents but by the times, then you've come to the right place.
Okay, I don't want to make light of this little emotional problem that the Speaker of the House seems to have.
I don't think that's a problem, but go ahead.
But the man has a little trouble getting through what would be considered to be a fairly straightforward speech without getting emotional.
Ron, I've cried through every podcast so far. What do you make of that?
I just don't know how to respond to that. Yes.
Well, anyway, the vote this week, of course, on in the Thursday vote for Speaker, 220 for Speaker Boehner, 192 for Nancy Pelosi. So there were defections on both sides.
All right. And there were a number of people who just voted present or voted for somebody else. There were three votes for Eric Cantor, who's the number two Republican leader.
There were two for Alan West.
Two for Alan West, who is a former member of the House who right. was just defeated for re-election, right. but of course was a very outspoken Tea Party member from Florida.
There were at least two for Jim Cooper of Tennessee. There was one for David Walker. Jim Matheson of Utah voted for John Dingell.
That's very interesting because yeah. John Dingell, of course, is the longest-serving member of the House
right.
ever.
He's like 12 feet tall.
And he has been there since
1955.
I was thinking of Bob Byrd there.
And you know who he succeeded?
He succeeded his father.
John Dingell Sr.
Who had been in the seat since the early years of the Depression.
Also, Thomas Massey of Kentucky voted for Justin Amash.
Who was one of the members of the House in the Republican Party from Michigan, who was disciplined by John Boehner back in December and stripped of his committee assignments.
But there was no outright rebellion against John Boehner, even though during his handling, or maybe attempted handling, of the fiscal cliff crisis, a lot of Republicans felt that he left a lot to be desired.
Oh, I think he left a lot of them seething. One of the most interesting things about the vote for Speaker this week was that there were a number of Republicans, Michelle Bachmann, famous for running for president and then narrowly getting reelected to the House in November, Marsha Blackburn from Tennessee.
Yep.
And they were standing off to the sidelines. And even though their names came up fairly early in the roll call alphabetically, they didn't vote. And then later on, when they called the roll a second time and it was clear that John Boehner had just barely made it.
No. At the end of the
first. Just barely
at
made
the
it.
He was one vote short at the end of the first roll. And then he did the voters. The
they
members
came around again.
Yes, yes.
And a couple, three other yeah. people kind of chimed in, well, okay. And one sort of has to wonder how those people would have voted if there really were a realistic chance of denying him the Speaker's gavel. Then if he falls short, they go back into conference and try to find somebody else they can nominate.
Before we go into the fiscal cliff conversations, one quick thing about another possible rebellion that didn't happen. A few Republicans from New York and New Jersey, such as Peter King from Long Island, Michael Grimm from Staten Island.
Really the hardest hit district.
Yeah, and it's basically we're talking about like voting against Boehner because of his decision, although since reversed, not to have any kind of vote regarding the funding for
Well, now, is that really a reversal? Is that really a reversal? Or did he just essentially say first to them, yes, we're going to vote you your aid, and we're going to do it before the end of the 112th Congress. And then he reversed himself and put it off to do it after the beginning of the 113th Congress. And he did that, at least this is what we get back door from his people, that it just was too unseemly to first pass this tax increase.
Without the promised spending cuts.
Without the promised spending cuts, which have been pushed off for 2 months. The whole idea of the sequester, the whole idea of reducing spending, pushed off for another 2 months while we do raise taxes now. That was hideously unpopular with John Boehner's caucus. So first he asks them to vote for that, and then he asks them to spend another $60 billion to bail out New York, Connecticut, New Jersey.
Right. I think that's what it was all about. Not that he didn't want to have that bill come up. He didn't want to have it come up 5 minutes after a near revolt with the Republican conservatives. Right.
So on Monday night, he didn't bring up the vote on Sandy. On Tuesday, he didn't bring up the vote on Sandy. On Wednesday, he didn't bring up the vote on Sandy. That Congress died, and the New York delegation, the New Jersey delegation, went nuts. Chris Christie, among others, really teed off on John Boehner.
This used to be something that was not political. You know, disaster relief was something that you didn't play games with. But now, in this current atmosphere, everything is the subject of one-upsmanship. Everything is a possibility, a potential piece of bait for the political game. And it's just, it is why the American people hate Congress.
Well, certainly a lot of Republicans were hating John Boehner leading up to that vote, Chris Christie and Michael Grimm and Peter King regarding Hurricane Sandy, and also a lot of Republicans in the House who hated the fact that basically John Boehner acquiesced, let the vote come up in the House on the fiscal cliff without the promised spending cuts. So I guess I'm still not convinced John Boehner is a clear loser in the whole thing, because the Republicans did get, for the most part, permanent Bush-era tax cuts that never had happened before. I mean, Barack Obama said, absolutely not, we're going to get rid of them. Now they're permanent. But
only on income under $400,000 for individuals and under $450,000 for couples.
Exactly right. But here you also have the Speaker of the House with his number two and number three, with Eric Cantor and Kevin McCarthy voting against him, voting against the Speaker on the fiscal cliff. You know there's some tension there. Now, ultimately, they did vote for him on Thursday's vote for Speaker. But I wonder what's going to happen to the unity of the Republican Party at the end of February when the next crisis, when the next henny-penny end of the world crisis comes, which is the debt limit vote.
We have the debt limit. We have this sequestered, these cuts in spending that were pushed off for 2 months in this most recent deal, which was essentially worked out by Joe Biden, the vice president, and Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, and then delivered kind of fait accompli, dumped in the lap of the House Republicans with this sort of mandate of, well, either we're going over the cliff and everybody's taxes are going up and you're going to get the blame, or you guys have to vote for this thing you had no vote, no voice in negotiating. And obviously they didn't like that. Obviously there was a rebellion. 150-some Republicans voted against it. Only 85 voted for it, and it passed on the votes of Democrats, who voted 10-1 in favor of it because they loved the chance to push something through, support the president, support the Democratic Senate, and defeat the House Republicans. They loved that, even though they didn't much care for the bargain itself, the fiscal cliff averting bargain.
And what seemed to get lost in this whole shuffle is that there were a sizable number of Democrats, not so many who voted against it, but at least voiced their complaints that Obama gave away the store. Now, you're talking about how the Tea Party resents the fact that Boehner gave away so much, but the progressive left wing of the Democratic Party also talked about what Obama gave up, that he could have held firm on the $250,000 amount for taxes. He could have driven a harder bargain with the Republicans. It seemed like from the beginning, though, the president was more interested in getting a deal than putting his foot down on the neck of the Republicans.
I think that while the Democrats, Tom Harkin most eloquently on the floor of the Senate, and several other Democrats who voted against the whole deal in the Senate, and as you say, many in the House, have a legitimate point to make here about the leverage that the fiscal cliff gave the president, this specter of huge spending cuts and taxes going up on everybody, he'll never get that kind of leverage back again. But you can make the argument that if he's trying to be president of all the people and not just of the most liberal Democrats in Congress, he may not want to use that leverage. He may not want to push the country over that cliff with all of the concomitant effects that could have happened, particularly to the economy and the growth that we're hoping is going to help the federal government deal with this debt and deficit problem.
Going back to winners and losers, we still debate whether John Boehner is truly a loser in this whole thing, but I think clearly a winner was Joe Biden.
Yeah, he got a chance to step out, be the most important person in the White House for a change, deal with his old colleague, I don't know if they're really friends, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader.
Mitch McConnell is certainly a closer friend with the vice president than he is with Harry Reid.
Yes. Harry Reid really got left out in this whole thing. It just sort of took the Senate majority leader and said, okay, Harry, you're not able to negotiate with Mitch McConnell. We're just going to supersede you.
And we have an actual quote from John Boehner. Here's what he had to say about Harry Reid. No, we can't play that quote.
No, that's right. They had a little exchange outside the Oval Office.
Yes.
And they were encouraging each other to... Never mind.
Right.
The final word, I think, on all this, and you spoke of it earlier, was, is John Boehner really in such tough shape that he's been portrayed as being this past week? Yes, he had a rough vote to get reelected as Speaker. Yes, a lot of people are saying terrible things about him in New Jersey and in Washington. But does he not come out of all of this, number one, still the Speaker? Number two, still more in charge than anybody else in his party in Washington, and still the leading figure of conservatism in the United States? I know that conservatives don't like him, don't love him, but he is their leading figure in terms of actually holding office.
Well, let's see what happens during the debt ceiling crisis in the end of February, which will be a crisis all over again, which will, you know, for all the celebrate, I don't think anybody's celebrating about the end of this fiscal cliff deal, but there is some relief, but that relief is not going to last long because both sides are, again, will be at loggerheads at the end of February. President Obama, of course, says, there's no way I'm going to negotiate with you guys on the debt ceiling because, after all, this is the spending that you, the Congress, already agreed to pay, so that's not negotiable. But the Republicans are going to insist, look, we didn't get the spending cuts we expected in this fiscal cliff deal. We're going to have to get it somewhere, and maybe we get it in the debt ceiling argument.
It's going to be interesting because, once again, the Republicans realize that their last really great leverage this year is raising the debt ceiling. And if they're going to do that, which responsible fiscal person would say you must, you've already spent the money, you have to honor the obligations that were incurred to pay for all that spending, you know, the debts that were incurred, they personally do not feel responsible for all that spending. They think they opposed that spending, therefore they don't really feel like they have to pay for it, or they're willing to take some sort of shock in the credit markets in order to finally bring the country to their point of view on spending.
And Mitch McConnell, going back to the winners and losers, it was Mitch McConnell who, realizing he couldn't work with Harry Reid, he was the guy who suggested, let's bring Biden into this whole thing. McConnell, I don't know if he seems to be the adult to the House Republicans' less...
Adolescence?
Well, perhaps.
Or hot-headed youth.
Well, I think that's fair to say, because I want to take sides here, but the point is, he said, look, a deal has to be made. We're not going to risk the economy going over the cliff along with everything else. And 89-8 is a pretty impressive margin, given the fact
40 Republicans in the Senate voted for it.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, only 5 Republicans voted against it, and the ones who voted for it include people like Pat Toomey, Tom Coburn, certain conservatives.
Ron Johnson of Wisconsin.
Even Jim DeMint, who didn't vote at all, but, I mean, he could have made a stink on it. You know, he's known for making a stink over decisions by the leadership of the Republican Party that he feels is wrong, and I don't think he was even part of this debate at all.
No, he wasn't. In fact, he pointedly stayed away for the whole fiscal cliff debate. He is going to be, of course, taking over as president of the Heritage Foundation here in this month.
We were talking about Congress and the fact that its leadership basically remains intact. John Boehner, Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, Mitch McConnell. But there are changes going on in the White House and in the cabinet.
That's right. We have a new Secretary of State designate or appointee in John Kerry. He hasn't been approved yet by the Senate. But when the Senate confirms him, he is expected to take over in that most prominent role. And we're expecting the president, perhaps in just the next few days, in the week of January 7th, to tell us about his plans for Secretary of Defense, a new CIA director replacing David Petraeus, and perhaps a new National Security Advisor as well. well.
And Secretary of Treasury Tim Geithner announced this week also that he will officially be leaving. I guess everybody feels it's going to be Jack Lew as his replacement.
Yeah, for Secretary of Treasury.
Right. So, and we haven't heard much about Chuck Hagel in a long time since the controversy about comments about gays, about
the Jewish lobby.
Jewish lobby, things like that.
He's been quiet, yeah. And his critics have kind of moved on to talking about fiscal cliff and what have you.
Right.
There have been other subjects for people to be distracted by. I suspect this next week we'll get back to talking about Chuck Hagel in a big hurry, especially if the president names him. I do not know. I'm not sure anyone knows if the president has decided on Chuck Hagel to be his Secretary of Defense.
And another bit of conversation that we seem to have forgotten about is guns.
You know, this is the thing. This is what happens with gun control. I mean, the kids in Sandy Hook are just going back to school now, and the emotional force of that is yet to really leave the country. But you already have this sense that the inevitability everybody felt for a matter of days or weeks right after Newtown is already beginning to dissipate, and that the usual political forces that assert themselves on behalf of gun freedoms and Second Amendment are going to prevail again, and there won't be any major change in guns laws. We'll see. I don't want to prejudge this, but one just has this sense that when Congress comes back, Congress is still Congress, and the Second Amendment is still supreme.
Now, we do have an inaugural address coming up. We do have a State of the Union coming up. So we do know that guns are supposed to be part of the president's second term agenda. So we'll see. But right now, it seems like it's a conversation. I agree with completely with what you just said, that for all the outrage, for all the sense of urgency, it seems like, well, we're back to where we started. Let's see if that's the case after the inauguration. We also were talking a little bit about, the new Secretary of State, the new cabinet. It's interesting, in the battle to succeed John Kerry, who will ultimately resign from the Senate, we will once again get another special election in Massachusetts. Last one, of course, after Ted Kennedy died. This one after John Kerry leaves. And what seems to be a surprise to me is that a lot of Democrats are coalescing around Congressman Ed Markey.
All right, but Ed Markey has been a prominent figure, somebody who is well-known statewide, even though he was just a congressman and not a statewide office holder, for a very long time. He's easily the senior member of the congressional delegation.
1976.
And yet he is still young enough to serve a couple of terms in the Senate if he should be so fortunate as to be elected. But interestingly, Scott Brown, the Republican who was just ousted from that special election one seat that he got after Ted Kennedy died, he was already out there kind of going after Ed Markey about, does he even have a house here in Massachusetts?
Yeah.
He kind of is married to Washington, isn't he?
I've never seen him on the plane.
Exactly. So that looks a little bit like game on, doesn't it? I mean, doesn't it look like Scott Brown wants to take Ed Markey on?
Well, first of all, Markey, once upon a time, was planning to run. He announced briefly in 1984 and backed away. I wonder if John Kerry appreciates that fact, that he hasn't forgotten the fact that Markey was going to run against him briefly in 84. He backed away. But Vicky Kennedy, Senator Kennedy's widow, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, and Michael Bennett said, we're all behind Ed Markey.
That's right.
That's a shock to people like Congressman Stephen Lynch, who really want it, Michael Capuano, other Democrats who are looking at it. But right now, it seems like a united Democratic Party. You often don't hear those words go back to back to back.
That is correct. I think the Democrats are taking this race a lot more seriously than they took that special election for Teddy Kennedy's seat. They had a candidate in Martha Coakley who was perhaps, less than perfect. She's actually improved as a politician since she was pretty bad that time around. And Scott Brown was a pretty strong candidate. He was a surprisingly good Republican candidate, riding some of the Tea Party enthusiasm of that winter. This time, if the Democrats can reproduce what they were able to do for Elizabeth Warren in 2012, if they can be united and be enthusiastic about their candidate, well, after all, it's Massachusetts, and the overwhelming Democratic advantage in registration should be enough for Ed to win.
I agree completely. And the fact is, Scott Brown in 2013 is not the same Scott Brown in 2010.
He's not?
Well, certainly he's not as well-liked as he was in 2010 when he was young.
He was new.
And the Democrats and President Obama were not that popular. Whereas in 2012, he kind of soiled his good name by being a little angry during the debates, a little negative, a little personal.
He didn't handle Elizabeth Warren very well.
No, he did not.
And we didn't think she was going to be such a formidable candidate, and she seemed to be kind of hapless for a while. But then in the late summer and in the fall, she really found her stride.
Right, and I think that surprised Scott Brown, and he did not handle that. But there's another surprise, speaking of surprises, happened in Hawaii when, in the aftermath of the death of Daniel Inouye, who's been a senator for 50 years, his dying wish was,
Pauline Hanabusa
to be the next senator, and he indicated that to with a contact to Governor Neil Abercrombie
in writing. I mean, yeah. It was a letter. It wasn't just a whisper under his breath. This was a letter.
So instead, Governor Abercrombie picked his Lieutenant Governor Brian Schatz, which was completely unexpected.
Everybody thought it'd be
Colleen Hanabusa,
especially Colleen Hanabusa.
Well,
not
she's,
taking it very
no,
well.
No, you know something. I mean, even though she says I wish Brian Schatz well,
and of course support, she does.
But there seems to be hinting that either Brian Schatz or Governor Abercrombie himself may get challenged in the primary in 2014 by people loyal to Hanabusa or loyal to Inouye.
Or possibly Hanabusa herself.
Yeah.
And she would probably feel a little bit more like it was Neil Abercrombie who had it coming than Brian Schatz.
There seem to be a lot of reasons why the choice was made. First of all, Brian Schatz is 21 years younger than Hanabusa. Seniority is very important to a state like Hawaii. He, the governor, didn't want to take Hanabusa out of the House and give the Republicans an opportunity to win a special House election, which is what happened with Charles DeJoux a few years ago.
Oh, I remember that.
That's right. So, so there's also that. But also the fact that Inouye was not a big fan of Abercrombie when Abercrombie was running for governor in 2010. I just wonder if
what
it was a little, look,
around.
I'm the governor, and this is my party, and you can cry if you want to.
Okay. Well, that all makes sense. Here's a salient chance for us to be bipartisan. Some good news on the medical front for both former President George H.W. Bush, who was taken out of intensive care and still in the hospital, but out of intensive care and seems to be improving. He is 88, and we watch his health carefully. And, of course, Hillary Clinton, the current Secretary of State, about to retire from that job and seen as the front runner for president in 2016, has been hospitalized following what was originally a stomach virus that apparently caused some dehydration, apparently leading to a fall when she fainted. And she has been diagnosed as having suffered a concussion in that fall. And then subsequently, after a reexamination, doctors in New York determined that she also had a blood clot behind her right ear in the space between her brain and her skull, and that's a very serious malady.
It is. If it was not caught in time, and obviously they saw it right away, they treated it with blood thinners. The good news, she's already out of the hospital and has reported back to work at the State Department.
Okay, but is that really absolutely satisfying good news to everybody? I mean, she has a lot of critics. If you look at the blogosphere, if you look at the websites and so forth, talk radio, a lot of people are suggesting that this, I mean, John Bolton, the former U.N. ambassador, questioning whether or not this was a rather strategic, diplomatic
to keep
ailment.
Her from testifying about Benghazi before Congress. Now, I did hear that a lot about the concussion. I have not heard that since when the blood clot was announced. Let's hope that nonsense has gone away. But as you say, you know, you don't wish ill of anybody. You really don't. And it's great news about former President Bush and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
And I suppose we should also end this podcast by saluting John Boehner. Not exactly landslide John in being reelected Speaker of the House, but after the week that he'd had, it's a pretty remarkable outcome and a success for him.
And before we go, I just want to point out that the startling news that the former Vice President of the United States has changed his name from Al Gore to Al Jazeera.
Well, okay. He didn't change his name from Al Gore to Al Jazeera. He sold his television operation
to Al Jahis.
Current TV right. To Al Jazeera, which will be very interesting to see whether or not that just means Current TV disappears and turns over some of its cable channels. Of course, its cable capacity is what Al Jazeera was really interested in here, not Al Gore.
Shouldn't you be
finishing your sentences? And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at
npr.org/politics. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm
Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR. You did it again, Ron.
I don't find this stuff amusing anymore. If you be my bodyguard, I can be your long-lost pal. I can call you Betty, Betty, when you call me, you can call me Al. A man walks down the street, he says, why am I short of attention? Got a short little span of attention, and oh, my nights are so long. Where's my wife and family? What if I die here?